Forester here on a rainy Tuesday. We have four Senate bills in front of us here today. We'll try to get through kind of session. Session is 10, I believe. Is that correct? Yeah. So we have an hour and a half, but we'll try to get through most of them. Senate Bill 1212, we'll have a short hearing on it. We won't be moving that out today because we have some more amendments coming for that one. The other three, I believe we have everything to move them out if we want to. We have fiscal reports and everything for those three.
Those are unchanged, Mr. Chair, those are unchanged from the Senate side, so we do have fiscals and revenues for all of these.
So, the committee's pleasure, we can act on the other three. So, if it's that, we'll start with Senate Bill 179. We'll open a hearing on that bill. Harrison, while we're checking our paperwork, can you tell us what this does?
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 179 increases license and endorsement fee limits for farm labor contractors. That includes people who provide forestry labor. It allocates the fees to the Bureau of Labor and Industries for administration of the program. I would want to call your attention to, in the background on the SMS I provided for you, the farm labor contract fee is increased from $20 to the $100, but with the farm labor contracts with forestation or reforestation endorsement, those are actually increased from $100 to $250, not $20 to $250.
As you can see, the farm labor licensing program, we're not talking about camps, we're talking about contractors here in this bill, aren't we?
We are talking about contractors, although there is an endorsement for a farm labor camp, which is in addition to one of these farm labor contract fees.
Okay. And so we're going to need to hear from Boley today on this issue because they're that's the department that licenses and issues these endorsements. So with that, we have the Honorable Jack Roberts here. This is, okay? Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Sounds like, Your Honor, you need a little more money. What's new, huh?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jack Roberts, Commissioner of the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. This is not a situation that any of us likes to be in, of coming back and saying we need to increase fees. Let me give you a little bit of background. As you pointed out, what we're talking about are farm and forest labor contractors. These are the folks who go out and solicit, recruit, hire, provide, generally oversee the work for and primarily migrant, although not exclusively migrant farm workers, but basically farm workers and in reforestation that oversee that under contract with the farmer or with the woodlot owner. We've been licensing this since the 1960s. The fee for farm labor contractors of $10 was set back in the 1960s and has never been increased. In 1982, the license for reforestation was increased at the urging of people in that industry to say we need to have a tougher licensing program and we need to do a better job. And so that's when the $100 fee was imposed for those who have a dual farm and forest contractor's license. It's not been increased. That has not been increased since 1982. When I came in, we actually had a number of activities that we were licensing. We licensed TV and radio repair, we licensed court reporters, and we licensed private employment agencies. And as a group, all of those license activities basically paid the cost of the licensing. It did not pay for enforcement. That comes out of the general fund. We're not asking for that. But the cost of getting the applications, testing the applicants, approving that, and handling the paperwork on renewal and all that together made our licensing activity self-supporting. When I came in, we looked at all those activities and felt that we really didn't need to be doing a lot of that. And so we asked the legislature in 1995 to eliminate the licensing for TV and radio repair, and that was done. We also worked with the courts to shift the licensing of court reporters from us to the courts, who are the ultimate consumers and who are the people who really were in the best position to provide and meet their needs. And so that was eliminated. We also supported a bill that was introduced in the legislature in 1995 to eliminate the licensing of private employment agencies because of the change in that industry from primarily applicant-paid to employer-paid. That was passed in 95 but was vetoed by the governor. We worked with the governor's office to address his concerns. It was then passed in 97, and that was also eliminated. That left as our sole licensing activity farm and forest labor contractors, which we believe is appropriately with us and we think is an important function. But it also revealed to us that for years we had been subsidizing that activity out of the other activities, particularly the private employment agencies, who were paying a fairly significant fee for very little regulation. As a result of that, we now have a nearly $50,000 hole in our budget that has to be paid for out of the general fund. Because the licensing activity, we believe, primarily serves the industry and its customers, it does certainly provide important protection for workers, but it also provides a very important protection for the farmers and the woodlot owners who hire the contractors and who want to know they're dealing with reputable people who are complying with the law and making sure people get paid. And so, consequently, this has always had a high level of support from the people in the industry. And so even though this is a large percentage increase, it is a large percentage increase because we have not increased it for a long time. It is also a large percentage increase because we believe that's what's necessary to make this a pay-as-you-go system. And therefore, we proposed this. It passed, I believe, without dissent in the Senate. It has not had any opposition. I won't say that there is enthusiastic support from those whose fees are being increased. But they've looked at it and said, we support the program, we think it's important, and we think we should pay our own way. It also has a lot of support, as I say, from the farmers who do not pay the license fee themselves, but who want to make sure we have a strong licensing program so the people that they deal with, they know are reputable and that they know are meeting the legal obligations, which, when they don't meet them, often fall back on them. And so, for those reasons, we believe that the request we're making is appropriate. It is included currently in our budget. Our budget has now moved out of the Ways and Means Subcommittee. Since I've been Labor Commissioner, we have reduced our budget from 10% below what it was when I came in. And that's not just 10% of the current service level or rate of growth. It's actually 10% less money than our current budget than the one we had the biennium before I came here. In the Ways and Means Committee, we are taking a 5% reduction from our current service level. We are supporting that. We think we can do that without reducing our core functions. We've reduced our FTE from 160 to 128. We have been economizing. We're trying to operate this as efficiently as we can, but we believe it's important that license activities such as this pay its own way and that the taxpayers generally not be subsidizing that. And so based on that, I would urge you to approve Senate Bill 179.
I see in Section 6 it says that this is a one-year license. And it talks about renewal of the license there in that section. Members, if you haven't caught that yet. Any questions from the committee? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to admit, Commissioner, that when I saw the amount that these increases were going, I did get a little heartburn over that.
So did I, Representative Crummell.
I'm sure you did. But my question is, would this be an appropriate type of fee? And I'm going to get catcalls probably from my colleagues here, but an appropriate type of fee that should actually be indexed. I mean, it hasn't been changed in, would you say, 30 years, and is something that probably there are increased costs some years, decreased others. But I'm just wondering if this wouldn't be an appropriate type of fee to be indexed so that you don't have to keep coming back to the legislature to get it, and it would continue to pay for itself irrespective of what the economy did.
Commissioner, Representative Crowell, I think that's always an issue that's important to look at, and I think that often we do get ourselves in a box by not providing for automatic, at least a review, if not an index, on a lot of these costs, because what happens is you don't want to come back for a small increase. You can swallow that pretty soon. One biennium turns into three or four, and then you are looking at a huge one. I would probably argue against that in this case, however, because I'm afraid that indexing removes an incentive for people to try to find ways to become more efficient, to handle these things more effectively. For example, we don't generally use dedicated employees who only do this, because the licensing activity often falls in peaks and valleys, and we try to use people to do other things. I think it's important that we continue to have an incentive to try to find ways to operate within existing resources, and indexing it might undermine that. I do think it's important that we, as other agencies, make a commitment to review these on a regular basis and come to you earlier rather than later, and not keep putting it off till we absolutely can't avoid it, and have a better interchange on how these rates are reviewed on a regular basis. But I think your point is a good one, but I would probably come down against that at this point.
I think why don't you just stay right there, Jack, and we'll have Martin Desmond come up from the Northwest Forestry Contractors signed up, and that way if any questions come up, we can ask you. Martin is the only other person signed up for this bill, so these will be our two people that are being testified. Welcome.
Chairman Wells, distinguished state senators, my name is Martin Desmond. I'm the acting director for the Northwest Forestry Contractors Association. It's an association of 35 contractors, primarily here in Oregon, but we also have members in Washington
here.
and Idaho.
I'd hate to make this, but I hate to have somebody impugn me before we start. He called us a senator.
Oh,
that's even a compliment. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Chairman Wells, Representative Thompson, excuse me very much. Our association has been working for the last 10 years to help level out the playing field so that all contractors have an opportunity to compete fairly for both public and private forestry contracts. During the past decade, our association has worked with a number of federal and state agencies to improve the working conditions of the forest industry. We've certainly been working quite closely with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Most of the time we work hand in hand, and sometimes we have certain differences of opinion, such as we had a couple weeks ago over Senate Bill 1267, but I'm glad to say that we ironed out those differences and we're back on track once again. As Commissioner Roberts mentioned, forestry and farm labor contractors are licensed through the Bureau of Labor and Industries. In regards to Senate Bill 179, our association does agree with the concept that forestry and farm labor contractors should pay for the licensing costs to cover BOLI's administrative fees. Senate Bill 179 would raise the basic license fee for forestry contractors from $100 to $250. Obviously, most people don't like to have their taxes raised upon themselves. As such, our association is somewhat hesitant to support increased licensing fees. However, our association is not opposed to this bill, and we would encourage the House committee to pass this bill. I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
I think the basic issue here is that how long have we been licensing farm contractors? Didn't this start in the late 80s? We had some problems with farm labor contractors, and that's when we instituted this program. Does anyone know when we started this program?
Sure, we actually started licensing them back in the 60s, but in 1989, substantially strengthened this because of concerns what was going on in that area, and we've been operating under that rule basically for the last
year. Seems like what ran in my mind was in the late 80s when I was first around here.
And what's interesting, if I can interrupt just a second, is that at that time we didn't increase the cost, but we did beef up the enforcement. A lot of that has been absorbed by the general fund, and we're not asking to change that. We're not trying to subsidize the enforcement out of the fee. We think the fee ought to just pay for the licensing, but there has been a substantial increase in our role and our responsibility since 89.
I think the basic issue, of course, looking at these fees and the administration of such a program, of course, is whether we're getting our dollars worth, whether the program is doing what we wanted to have done, and that whole thing. Sometimes we institute programs, but are we really accomplishing anything with licensing farm contractors or forestation contractors at all? Are we accomplishing anything with that program?
Sure, I believe that we are. We have one of the most stringent laws in the country regulating farm and forest labor contractors. I wish I could tell you that all the problems out in the area of farm and forest labor contractors and in the area of farm workers and migrant farm workers generally has been so, obviously it's not, it's a very sensitive area, and it's one where you have a lot of vulnerable people. I think we do a good job, and I think that our laws are good. There's been some discussion recently about can we beef up enforcement. We can probably always do more, and if we had unlimited resources, we probably would put more people out in the field on the enforcement side. But I think that the laws we have today are adequate. I think they're being enforced well. We do have, what we do is being supplemented by private groups that help us with that. So I think on balance, the situation in the field is much better than it was in 1989. I think that our laws is good and it's working well. And I think the licensing is the linchpin of that to make sure that we have people who have to conform to certain standards and that we have strong enforcement for those who don't.
Chairman Wells, if I might add, I've been working in this industry for the last 10 years, and the Bureau of Labor and Industries is actually one of the more effective agencies out there. The U.S. Department of Labor, contractors are also required to be licensed under the Federal Migrant and Agriculture Seasonal Protection Act, and I hate to be too harsh to the federal government, but generally I have a very low opinion of the USDOL's enforcement of NISPA, plus there's a lot of basic problems with the way in which they go about trying to enforce it. But the Bureau of Labor and Industries tends to be much more pragmatic and generally focuses on what the real issues are. So they're a much more effective agency than their federal counterpart.
I think with that, Representative Thompson.
You're ready to move the work session. I'm more than happy to.
I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 179 and open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Thompson.
I'd like to move Senate Bill 179 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion of the motion? Call the roll, Samantha, please. Yes.
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 Aye.
Aye. Yes.
He's excused this morning.
All right.
Senate Bill 179, motion is passed and removed to the floor. Anyone interested in carrying this?
I'll carry.
Representative Thompson will carry. So with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 179 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 235. Well, we're looking at our paperwork. Harrison can tell us what this bill does.
Let's see if I can find my paperwork. Mr. Chairman, members, Senate Bill 235A engrossed is a bill that authorizes the Department of Agriculture to impose civil penalties not to exceed $10,000 excuse me, for violation of agricultural quarantine orders, quarantine rules, control area orders, failure to pay imported timber inspection fee, or unlicensed or improper activity as a grower or dealer agent for plant nurseries, unlicensed activity as a Christmas tree. There are a number of different areas in which the civil penalty might apply. The bill does require that the department establish a schedule for the penalties in rule that gives some guidance as to what level of penalty will be provided for the various violations.
I remember in 95 is when we instituted the program on imported timber, I believe, that bill was passed because we were starting to, as interestingly enough, the greatest timber growing area in the world or in the United States, so we'd run out of timber and now we were going to import timber in. And so we set up an inspection program at the ports. That was an issue we dealt with in 95 in this committee.
Mr. Chair, members, I should probably also mention that there is a sunset here. It prohibits the levying of a penalty for violations after December 31st, 2001, and the operative provisions, in fact, are repealed December 31st, 2002.
And why do we have a sunset?
Mr. Chair, sorry. Could I speak to that issue?
Yes.
I'll testify in the bill, and I'll do it rather than going down here.
Mr. Chair, the reason the sunset is there, and I'd like to first compliment the Department of Ag and their staff people, because what happened with this bill, as I think you well know, is when we had our overview meeting, I was informed at that point in time that the fact that this bill was been printed, and the Christmas tree people have not been spoken to about it.
So since then, we've been meeting with Chuck and Dan from the Department of Agriculture, and they've worked, you know, bent over backwards to accommodate any concerns that the Christmas tree growers had with the bill and the civil penalties. And the sunset is there at the request of the Christmas tree industry because of the inability or the lack of participation by both the department and the industry in the last 10 years of the licensing program. The industry and the department are supposed to have a Christmas tree advisory committee that meets at least annually. That has never really happened and never been effective. So the industry people were very insistent that if we're going to impose new civil penalty authority to the department, that we want to make sure that both sides do what they're supposed to do. So we put into the bill that this advisory committee will meet at least twice a year and review the schedule, the civil penalties, and make sure that both sides are doing as they're supposed to be doing. And the sunset was put there as a way to make the industry buy into the civil penalty authority and to make sure that both sides do what they're supposed to do. So I'd just like to say that, you know, the Christmas tree industry supports the bill as it's now written with the changes we put in. The president of the association is here.
Yeah, we have Julie Hoffman who's going to be here.
Again, thank the department for working with us on this issue.
So with that, welcome Chuck and Dan. As I understand, then a civil penalty is something new. This is part of the new addition to this issue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chuck Craig, Assistant Director of the Department of Ag. With me is Dan Hilburn, our Plant Division Administrator. Yes, we currently do not have the authority to levy civil penalties for violations of these laws.
Go ahead and give your testimony on it.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I think I'm going to have Dan summarize where we've ended up with the bill. I think it's safe for me to say at this point that we have consulted with the affected industry groups and that they're all on board with the bill. So.
Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Dan Hilburn. I'm Administrator of the Plant Division for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I think Harrison did an excellent job of summarizing the pieces of law that we have that would be affected by civil penalties if this bill passes. And in our testimony, I think probably the need is where I'd like to concentrate down at the bottom. I'll give you a few examples of situations that have come up in the past year or two that where we just don't feel that we have the regulatory tools to deal with them. And the first one there is a landscape contractor who's also a nurseryman who has brown garden snail on his property. And this is a pest that is not established in most of the growing areas of Oregon, and it's a very serious pest. It could be a significant pest for the nursery industry as well as vegetable and flower growers and fruit growers. So it's something that we have a quarantine against, and we do not want that pest spread. Well, this man is very busy, and we have issued him a directive to clean up his property, get rid of the snails, and given him a schedule of treatments, and he has been lax in doing that. And we have been out to his property several times, and he just got other things on his mind, and we just don't feel that we have the tools to get his attention the way that we would like. Another example would be our quarantine against selling filbert trees in the state. Ornamental filberts, like contorted filberts, are carriers of eastern filbert blight. And the nursery industry and the filbert industry together worked with us to implement a 5-year moratorium on selling contorted filberts in the state, and we occasionally find those trees at retail nurseries and have them destroyed. We have one wholesaler who has broken the rule twice, and for that second time, we would really like to be able to get their attention with a civil penalty if we had it. And finally, we know that we have several hundred people in the state who operate as either Christmas tree growers or nurserymen without paying the licenses, for licenses, and that is a violation of the law. Most of them come around when we visit them and send them letters, and a few of them simply thumb their nose at us, and we don't feel that we have the tools to get those people in line. So those are a few examples, I think. They tend to come up a few every year, except for the licenses, where we have several hundred every year that don't license.
Currently, what do you have at your disposal to enforce your regulations? Take someone to sue them under a civil penalty, civil case?
Mr. Chair, it's criminal penalties that we have. We have to obtain a conviction in court of law in order to collect any fines. And I've been here 9 years, and that has never happened. It's never been used in my experience. Chuck, your experience is even longer.
So how would you enforce a civil penalty if they didn't pay it? Then take them to court then.
Okay, if we did have civil penalty, you're right.
How are you going to enforce it?
I believe that we would write them a letter. If they don't pay their civil penalty, then we turn it over to the Department of Revenue.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me see if I can explain that. A person who has had a civil penalty assessed against them, which they have to be formally notified in writing by certified mail and so on like that, is entitled to a hearing before the department first. Depending on whether the subject of the civil penalty is satisfied with that process or not, they can go to the Court of Appeals afterward to appeal that civil penalty as an additional appeal step that they have. So in terms of enforcing it, what we would do would be typically, if it weren't paid, we could go to the county clerk in the county where the person business was and file with the county clerk for a collection of that. They could put a lien on property or exercise the means that they have to collect penalties.
Representative Uberlaw, you have any ideas how these things would be collected?
Well, I think that he is a stud, and they can take them after the hearing. And if the hearing is in favor of the department, they can. The Department of Revenue does collect some of them. I would assume that would be true.
They do. There is the possibility, too, I suppose, of going to court and asking the court to issue an order directing the person to pay it. And that, I can recall one case like that in the years I've been with the department, that there were more issues than that associated with the case, but in going to court, the judge ordered the individual to pay the penalty that was due as well.
It seems like we're getting judgments from a court, I suppose, might put the scare into an individual more than some department, some agency issuing a civil penalty. So I wondered, you know, what the reaction. We seem to be moving more and more to civil penalties, Fish and Wildlife Division, all these agencies, and I was wondering just what is the reaction, how they really go about collecting these civil penalties.
Mr. Chairman, we have had good results. For one thing, we don't ordinarily issue a civil penalty unless the evidence is pretty clear-cut and the case is reasonably straightforward. I don't think there are very many cases where people have not ultimately paid that penalty. So,
for example,
thank you, Mr. Chair. The way the bill is drafted in terms of the civil penalty has to be in conformance with the Administrative Procedures Act.
Which is the hearing.
Which is the hearing process, and then that sets out in terms of how it can be collected and due process at that point. And I believe also that Representative Shetterly has a bill going through to change all of that this session as well. So in terms of that.
So with that, we have Julie Hoffman from the Christmas Tree Association. Maybe you can just stay there, Chuck, and if there's questions.
Okay, for the record, I'm Julie Hoffman.
Nice to have you with us.
Hi. I'm president of the Pacific Northwest Christmas Tree Association. I also serve on the advisory board for the Christmas tree department, I mean, the Christmas tree part of Department of Agriculture. We are in support, as Roger explained, particularly with the changes that had first come out with the sunset, as we want to stay and maintain a full involvement in enforcing. When this, and refresh me, Roger, as far as the penalties, the Christmas tree licensing is relatively new in the last 10 years or maybe?
85, I believe.
Is that 85? Okay. And that's about the time I came back into my family farm. And this arose because of some quarantine issues concerning gypsy moth that the we were not under a formal inspection. And so when it came to try to inspect and get our product out of the state is when we came into this program so that we are inspected and also with as far as shipping materials. We feel that this needs to have some enforcement and teeth to it to maintain the integrity of our exports. A big export is Mexico, particularly for us. California has always been high and large numbers. And without being able to export out, our industry would be very crippled. So we are in, very much in favor of putting some teeth and getting the unlicensed Christmas tree growers involved. So.
Thank you. Nice to have you here, Julie, and Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Up in my area, I have quite a few what would be commonly referred to as gentleman farms. I don't know most of the gentlemen that run them, but anyway. So let's say you have a couple of acres and you've gotten seedlings and you've planted trees and you're figuring that, you know, maybe in a few years you'll, for Christmas, kind of open it up and people can come and use that or whatever the case may be. Do they need to be licensed as Christmas tree growers?
I'm sorry, I was referred to the Department of Ag on the minimal.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, yes, they do.
Mr. Chair.
Representative,
there's a 2-acre exemption. If you have less than 2 acres in Christmas trees, you don't need a license.
Any other questions of this group that are testifying? I guess if not, we'll close the hearing. I'll send Bill 235 and open the work session.
Mr. Chair.
President Meyer.
I move Senate Bill 235, A and Growth, to the floor to be passed. Recommendation.
Motion to move to the floor. Any discussion on the motion? Let's call the roll, Samantha, please.
Chair Wallace?
Yes.
Representative Thompson?
Excuse.
Representative
Isabel?
Yes.
Yes.
Representative
Byers?
Aye.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Representative
Yes.
Representative Hummel?
Aye.
With that, Senate Bill 235 is moved to the floor with a due pass. Anyone interested in carrying this bill? Representative Byer, he's in the Christmas tree business.
Mr. Chair, I probably should know the potential conflict of interest because I am a licensed Christmas tree grower.
So noted. So with that, Representative Byer carrying, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 235, and let's see it. I have, who's here on 958? You want to be somewhere by 930, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, let's jump here. Let's like open hearing on Senate Bill 958, extends farmer for camps pilot program, and Mr. Johnson came up from the Medford area.
Yes, sir.
And it was nice to have you here today. You can tell us, Harrison, let's see what this bill does, and then we can find out what's going on here with this issue.
Mr. Chair, members, in 1995, a pilot program was established in Jackson County. It permits farm worker camps to be hooked up to water and sewage service if that service is already next to the property, and it does not require them to extend the service beyond its existing limits.
The program is available only in Jackson County. It has been used at least once in that area during the pilot period. It sunset in 1999, and these folks are here saying that they would like to see that program extended. They do, by the way, pay the costs for that service. There is a limitation which does not allow the property to be changed to a non-farm dwelling unless it's within an urban growth boundary. And I believe in the member packets we did provide some letters of support from local sanitation districts and I'm not sure who the other letter was from. Bear Creek Sanitary Authority and one other.
I think the issue here is that under current law, sewer and water services can't be extended out past city limits or urban growth boundaries, and unless they want to be annexed into the city. And so what we have here is an exception to that law or rule that would allow a farm worker camp to be hooked up to the city sewer and water services. And so with that, welcome Mr. Johnson from down in the Medford area. Maybe tell us about this and how you were able to get this small exception in our statutes.
That's probably the shortest bill written in history, at least this session.
I've been in on other arguments on this type of issue, and there's been quite a bit of hesitancy about allowing cities to extend sewer and water outside their urban growth boundary.
That's correct. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity this morning. And Mr. Chairman, you are correct. That's very controversial. In a nutshell, Mr. Connolly did a great job. We had to let him testify for everybody. His conclusions are tremendous.
Well, we need two or three shots to understand it, so just go right ahead. That was just the first blow, and then we sat here and tried to absorb that and all you.
What? Maybe rather than me reading this, I'll just try to hurry this along. And Bear Creek Corporation, when this was passed in 1995, there were about six or seven orchardists that had migrant farm worker camps, and they were all going to be improved. Well, the financial situation of the fruit industry in the last 4 or 5 years has not been very healthy, so consequently, much of that was not done. In fact, we were about the only ones that did anything about it. We have purchased several orchards in the last 2 years that were on the verge of bankruptcy, or the trees were going to be torn out and residential development was going to occur. We went in and bought those orchards. We removed the trees. We planted new trees. And along with that came some farm labor camps that were not very sanitary, not in very good condition. This bill really does not extend those services outside the urban growth boundaries. The water lines and the sewer lines are already adjacent to several of these. So,
but you do set outside the urban growth boundary, though, don't you, with your camp?
Actually, only in one orchard. And that would be Talent, but we can't hook up to those services anyway because those services are not adjacent to the property. We would actually then have to do what you're implying, and that's run them out from the city of Talent and through Jackson County, and we can't do that. This does not allow it. The only place we want to use this is where we have farm labor camps in place right now, and they're on septic and they're on wells, and the camps are very, very bad, and we want to replace those with new camps and upgrade the living conditions.
What is the issue here, though? It has to do with land use planning and zoning, doesn't it? That you can't get those services? What would keep you from being just hooked up to the city and sewer and water?
Yes, sir. You're correct.
Because you're outside of what? Some line that they've agreed to extend services to?
Yes, sir. And when this bill was originally passed in 95, everyone thought that this would be a good way to upgrade these camps. And as long as there were no residential services or expansion of the connections allowed, everyone was in agreement that this would be a good practice. And that's why the Medford Water Commission and Bear Creek Valley Sanitary Authority wrote letters of support to the committee, to Senator Hannon, saying that they agree with us, that this is not going to upset their apple cart in any way.
Mr. Chair, I would say if you know much about Jackson County is a can be a very contentious area when it comes to land use, and I have not received any objections to this. They have a Citizen League and other groups that give a great deal of oversight to what's happening, and I have had no one object to what they're trying to do.
The other thing I should point out, we have a 160-bed labor camp right now that is premier. It is state-of-the-art. It's very clean. It has all these services. We will be losing that in the next two or three years to the Jackson County Medford International Airport and their expansion. So we have to have a place to provide housing for those who harvest our crops.
Representative Hill.
What happens in 2003?
Hopefully we will have all this done. We're probably the only company in Jackson County that will be doing this. It would have to be done.
Representative Hill.
So then this does not need to be then? I guess I'm don't understand in terms of you're getting water and sewer to a place where large numbers of people congregate, which seems to be good public policy. And so after 2003, they don't need to be hooked up to water and sewer? Because it just sort of seems silly to me that we're extending
the sunset
on this and just get rid of it altogether. Rather than play this game, you know, if it's good public policy that their toilets flush and they have drinking water, I mean, why do we do this so that we can come back in, you know, the 2003 legislature and have the same discussion over again? I mean, who's against flushing toilets and drinking water?
Unfortunately, I was not involved in this in 1990, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, I was not involved in this in 1995, so I do not know why they put a sunset in it.
Let's bring John McCauley up, and I guess I'd like to remind you again, this is a land use issue. When you start extending sewer and water outside of the urban growth boundary, this becomes
a
contentious issue of whether
it's
they need to be annexed in. Well, we're going to allow more to be hooked up if you extend this time. Now, what would happen to the current ones that are hooked up once this sunsets? That's a question we need to have answered.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John McCauley representing tree fruit growers. That's a good question, because we didn't discuss that in 95 when the bill was eventually passed. The sunset date was put on it as a compromise because of the concerns that the cities and Thousand Friends had about making this too permanent, I guess. And that was the decision that was reached at that point.
So the people who got hooked up during this time then could stay hooked up permanently, just no more new ones could come on if this thing was allowed to sunset?
Mr. Chair, that was my understanding, the sunset was on the ability to extend these services and to take advantage of what was being done in the 95 legislation. Once the sunset occurred, then no more new extensions could occur, but those who are already there would be allowed to continue.
The issue, of course, reminds me of a bill that we had in, I think that was out of the Roseburg area. It was one that Senator Fisher was involved in. There was a group of houses that built up out on the outside of this town down there in this area, and they started having sewer and water problems, and so then they came to the city and said, We want to have an exception to extend a sewer and water line outside the urban growth boundary out to this. You know how sometimes these group of houses grow out in the country.
I know all too well.
And he came and wanted an exception for that one group of houses. And we had quite a little tussle about that bill, and actually that bill did not pass. And I don't know what happened to that group of houses as far as how they got their sewer and water and ran their houses to flush, so to speak. But the issue was not extending sewer and water lines outside the city.
Mr. Chair, I think another reason, if my memory is correct, from 1995, and it sometimes loses a little bit in the process, but Jackson County is one of the fastest growing areas there is in the state, and one of the concerns is if you put something in there permanently, you could be affecting where they wanted to go in the future as far as planning, that type of thing. You don't want to overload the system with something that's not traditionally done. And actually, it's my recollection there's only one outfit that has actually hooked up since 1995. Is that what you remember, Lee?
I believe, yes.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I might also add that when we were working on the bill in 95, I think we had identified four or five growers who might be able to take advantage of this, and then the anticipation was that at the end of this initial sunset period, all of those who wanted to take advantage of the program would have, and obviously you're being asked to extend it because that did not occur. But we think there is such a finite number who qualify under the limitations in the bill that an extension beyond the sunset, probably 2003, would not be needed.
Representative Decker. Well, nice to have you here with us today.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm grappling with two things, Mr. Johnson or John. First, again, it's two principles. First would be the notion that migrant workers are included in the community and the push to get them back into the community where services are and educational facilities are. And so that thrust, and also, I guess, the second principle, which is that we ought to constrain growth or restrict growth to within urban growth boundaries. And so I'm just grappling and trying to think of a situation that I'm not familiar with in that context and would want to know why this would be a good exception in terms of those two principles.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Deckert, on the properties that we're talking about with Bear Creek Corporation, there are existing facilities now. They're very run down. They use septic tanks and they use wells. There's nothing to prevent us from continuing to use septic tanks and wells. We'd rather not deplete the groundwater, and we'd rather not deal with the septic tanks if we don't have to in drain fields. So if these services run right up against our property line, it would make more sense from a sanitary and from a groundwater supply standpoint to hook up to those facilities that adjoin our property. As far as schooling and bringing people all together, that's fine. We participate in those. We have an education center at Bear Creek Corporation that is it's a nice facility, and we do all kinds of education for all of our employees. But having them all live in one place is probably not practical when we have four or five orchards spread around the valley.
Mr. Chair, if I might also take a stab at that, because Representative Deckert raises the issues that made this a three-session bill. Because of the concerns you raised, primarily about the extension into farm areas of the services, we spent a lot of time with Thousand Friends and the cities trying to come up with making this as narrow as possible so that it did not set a broad policy that this was an acceptable activity. And that's why you see all of the restrictions that you do in the 95 legislation. And as a result of those restrictions, it limited it, like I say, to four or five farms who could actually take advantage of it. The second issue on the housing on farms, and obviously that is a controversial one, the fact is that there is an inadequate supply of housing for farm workers in the state, whether in town or on the farm. And it's been our very strong belief that wherever possible, we should be providing the best housing possible no matter where it was located. And in this situation where we've got a chance to improve the quality of that housing for a group of workers, we think it makes sense to do that. Even though some people may not like to have it located on the farm, the fact is we need the housing, and that's where it happens to be.
Representative Trumbull?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would note that it's a lot less expensive for the farmer to put it on property he already owns than it is to try to go buy other property. But with that said, in the title of this bill, it says extend, or in the explanation, it says extends farmer worker camp pilot program. So am I to understand then that eventually you would take the word pilot out of this and remove Jackson County and make this a statewide type of opportunity?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, it was never our intent. Well, take a step back from that. Our initial bills that we introduced starting in the 91 session would have made it a statewide program. Since the fruit growing areas of the state that I represent were most interested in this. There was no interest in the Hood River, Wasco County area. There's no interest in northeastern Oregon, in the Milton Freewater area for this. So as a matter of fact, Jackson County was the only fruit growing area interested in the bill. I would say that in 2003, if Bear Creek is successful with their projects, the pilot light will go out and the bill won't be, this legislation won't be needed anymore.
So John, looking at the statute here, Chapter 210, it doesn't limit it to just certain areas of the state. Isn't this statewide?
Mr. Chair,
Jackson County.
Section 2, up 1.
Oh, there it is. I missed it right there.
Okay, right. Mr. Chair, if you're ready to work session, we're ready to move.
Representative Hill has a question.
I don't understand why, this to me is a public health issue in terms of we have an opportunity to bring sanitary conditions to these camps. It seems ridiculous that it's only allowed in Jackson County. And to have a sunset on this, I mean, it's just ridiculous because the restrictions are so, the services have to be there. If they're there, let them hook up. If they're not, then they can't. So, but it's just a public health issue to me.
Well, it's a land use planning issue that gets into this whole issue, because public otherwise health. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. In the case of the group of houses that grows up outside the urban growth boundary, and pretty soon they've run out of water and sewer. Now they want to come back to the local city, yet they don't want to annex in. But we want the water and sewer extended out to them because we've got our little problem. You see, that's the issue.
Public health. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Making you're saying that brought up another question, and that is that I know that it's generally accepted practice for cities to charge if you're not in a special district but you're getting your services from a city, and if you are outside the city limits, it's customary for a city to charge double what they would charge a consumer inside the city limits. How does the city of Medford charge you for this, Mr. Johnson? Are you charged on a double, or do you pay the same rates that people in the city pay?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, it's my understanding that we will pay the same rate as everyone else pays in a commercial development.
Okay.
I'm on the Medford Water Commission, by the way, and believe me, when we had our discussion about writing a letter of support, we had much of this same conversation, and for the Medford Water Commission to unanimously support this was also a step, because we are very selfish about what we do with our water hookups outside the urban growth boundary.
Any other questions? No, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 958.
Mr. Chair.
And open work session on Senate Bill 958.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Verbaugh.
I move Senate Bill 958 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
We have a motion to move to the floor. Any discussion on the motion? Let's call the roll, Samantha.
Chair
Wells. Yes.
Yes.
Representative Fire.
Aye.
Representative Hill.
Aye.
Representative Becker?
Yes.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Trumbull?
Aye. Motion passes. Do we have a carrier on this? Representative Rubelaw, is that your area?
Yeah.
I can carry that. So with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 958. Now we have one more bill left. We'll open a hearing only on Senate Bill 1212. And as I stated earlier, we won't be moving that out today. We have some amendments that are coming that we're going to have some testimony on this issue, because even though we have amendments to this issue, I think we'll still be with us. What does this bill do, Harrison?
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 1212A restricts the sale of unpasteurized milk, fluid milk, or dairy products. It includes goat milk in the restriction. It allows goat milk to be sold that is either pasteurized or produced by a herd free of known disease. In the case of cow milk, it requires that it be pasteurized. We do have an amendment which was just handed out. Actually, I should also mention that the bill as written has two conflict amendments to address differences in Senate Bill 234, which we already passed through this committee. So there are two conflict amendments within the Dash A. There is also an amendment that was just handed out. Section 2 of the bill says cow milk must be pasteurized. At later points in the bill, it says pasteurized and produced by a disease-free herd. So that's what this amendment would fix, is would eliminate that requirement. For
you're looking at line 11 on page 3, is disease-free herd.
Is one of those places where it says cow milk must be pasteurized and produced by a disease-free herd. So the amendments would eliminate the disease-free herd requirement.
That's line 8, line 8 and line 11.
I just received this. I thought that there were a couple of other places.
There's another amendment. There's another amendment which we don't have yet. We'll have the next time it's built back. So this is the amendment we're waiting on. So with that, we have Oregon Dairy Farmers, and then we have some people here from the Health Division. The Health Division came in and talked to me yesterday about this, and they're going to have somebody here testifying concerning the hazards of unpasteurized milk. And so with that, we'll start out with Dave Nelson and John Moyson. Nice to have you here. Dave?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson, representing the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. And with me on the on my right, your left, is Don Moyson, who's the legislative chairman and a dairyman himself, as a dairy farm does on the north side of Salem. And Lorenda Moholt from the Oregon Dairy Products Commission in Portland. Just to give you a bit of history on the politics of the raw milk bill, raw milk has from time to time seen episodes of disease outbreak associated with various foodborne pathogens, which can be discussed much more intelligently by Dr. Cieslak and others in the room. Raw milk has been an issue of debate for some time, and since Louis Pasteur became famous in the history books for saving thousands of people by developing the pasteurization process. In 1995, there was an incident of E. coli outbreak associated with a raw milk dairy south of Portland. We came to the legislature at that time saying it's time to just stop sale of raw milk because of the possibility of these episodes occurring. The legislature, because of individuals' concerns over regulating individual businesses and prohibiting sale of raw milk at that time, chose not to do that. We've come to a point in history where all of the dairy raw milk, or all of the cow dairy raw milk producers have gone out of business. And so we come back to you saying now is the time to close the door so that we don't enter back into a period of time of producing commercial raw milk. I think most of the major retailers in the state choose to not sell raw milk because of the potential liability associated with it. So we are here, and as the chair said, we would offer other amendments next week, but today we just want to talk about the prohibition on further sale or reintroduction of sale of commercial raw milk. I'd like to introduce Don Moyson, who's the chairman of the Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the status of raw milk production in Washington and Idaho?
I can't answer that. Maybe Dr. Cieslak, when he testifies, can answer that. I know there are 23 states around the nation that have prohibited the sale of raw milk, and whether Washington and Idaho is one of those.
I'm almost sure.
Representative Roth.
The reason I'm asking that is because you've testified, and I've also heard otherwise, that we don't have any raw milk producers in Oregon, but because those states are contiguous, and if they had raw milk producers, we may be affecting, and we may not even be concerned that we're affecting it, but there's a possibility if they're selling into you know, their parts of, somebody's back there, just shaking his head.
But I don't think we can hear you, Chuck. Probably we need to bring a chair up here if we're going to share a microphone.
Mr. Chairman, Chuck, for the record, Ron McKay just informed me that it's against federal law to transport and pasteurize milk across the state border.
Just a question.
Okay, go ahead. We have Chuck and Ron McKay. They're going to testify later here, so we can hold our questions. Let's get on through here in the next 20 minutes or so here. Don, welcome. Nice to have you here today.
Thank you. Good morning, Representative Wells, members of the committee. My name is Don Moyson. I'm just west of Brooks, about 2 miles, with a 450-cow dairy. And today I'm representing the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. Currently we have 440 producers, and our farm gate value is about $220 million for the state. As Dave mentioned, the sale of unpasteurized milk historically has given problems for our dairy industry, and we feel that now is the time to close the door because there are no licensed producers that sell raw milk. So we think this would be a safeguard for our industry and protect us from problems relating to that, and would ask you to support Bill 12.
Don, what would happen to, when I was a young fella, we had a cow or two that we milked, and we had a couple of milk customers, jug milk customers, that came and bought milk from us. Wouldn't be able to do that anymore, or is there anyone that ever does that?
Representative Wells, members of the committee, I think that from a dairy industry standpoint, we are doing everything that we can to stop that, if that in fact is occurring. And the reason is because there is a potential of problems, and you know, that it could cause some serious problems if that raw milk were to get into, get something in it there and cause problems. So as an industry, we're trying to eliminate that. This legislation would prohibit the sale of unpasteurized milk. So
that's why I see that, so it would take care of the guy that's got one cow and has got 2 months for his own consumption and like to share it with his neighbor, then evidently it would take care of that problem.
You can always give it away.
Pour it out the chickens, I guess.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to earn my veterinarian degree here. We had earlier bills on brucellosis. Now, and goats have brucellosis?
That I can't.
We have an infirmity.
Right.
So, yes. Because the way this is written, we have the goats have to be tested for brucellosis, but not specifically cows, the way this sentence is reading.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, Oregon is a brucellosis-free designated state, as I understand today, and all cattle herds must be tested for brucellosis.
No, Chair, I appreciate
by other
that,
law.
But I'm just, it goes through and has some specific things that have to happen if they are tested with brucellosis. So in terms of, but the way this is written, it puts the word goat in front of herd, and so it specifically calls out goats versus cows. And I'm just curious why we would do that versus encompassing both cows and goats.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, I think I will defer that question to Ron McKay when he gets up here. He's very familiar with the interaction of those sections of the law, and if we could do that, I think it would be much more instructive.
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you. Why is it that it's okay to sell raw goat milk as long as it's from a disease-free herd, but it's not okay to sell raw cow milk, and especially if it came from a disease-free herd? I don't understand that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, representing the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, goats just simply weren't our issue when we drafted the bill. The issue of there is, as I understand, one goat dairy remaining in the state that is in southern Oregon that has a few customers that still want to buy raw milk from that lady. And so
We just simply chose, as a matter of beginning this issue, to deal only with cow milk, since that's what we represent. Mr. Chair.
President Cromwell.
I appreciate that you're from the Oregon Dairy Association, which denotes cows, but if your interest is in public safety, then I would think that unless there's a big difference between goats and cows, that they all ought to be taken out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, we would not disagree with that philosophy. We just simply took the approach that we were going to deal with the cows, and since we had gotten politically into trouble in 1995 by the argument that there are people who are producing raw milk and people who are consuming raw milk, and we're trying to deal with that. That since there was the one small goat dairy, we chose in the interest of the cow dairy industry to deal only with the cow dairy industry. It was simply a pragmatic political decision, we thought.
This is the politics of eating the elephant one bite at a time, and there are a lot of people out there who do buy raw goat milk and even raw cow milk because of they have feelings of natural foods, reactions and all that sort of thing, and so there has been a market out there for raw milk. I think with that, let's bring up Paul Sisolak from the Health Division. Okay, go ahead. Yes, excuse me.
Good morning, Chairman Wells, distinguished members of the committee. I'm Lorinda Moholt, and I'm the Director of Communications for the Oregon Dairy Products Commission. I got up fairly early to get here today, but didn't go to bed as late as my farmer friend Don Moisen, who was up till 2:30 planting his corn to get it in under the rain. I did get up early, however, because my home is not in Salem, and I realized on the way down that I had, before I came, eaten grapes from Chile, bread from a small Russian bakery close to my house, drank coffee from Jamaica. Milk, however, was from Oregon. I'm part of a global food community, just as you are. Our food comes from all over the place, and it's important upon us as citizens and as legislators to make sure that food is safe. I know the milk is safe. I know the milk I drank was just fine because the farmers produce the highest quality milk in the country. We know that, and that's not my statement. It's the USDA that says Don and his friends produce darn good milk. And I know that it was safe because it was pasteurized. You would probably expect me at this point to say, yeah, but I grew up on a farm and I was one of 10 kids and I drank raw milk all my life and I'm just fine.
Sure did.
The truth of the matter is there were only three in my family and I really wasn't from a farm. And I know that that contradicts some of your experience. But I also know that in today's world, not only do people who are growing up on farm not drink milk from cows that has not been pasteurized, they don't want you to drink it either. And that's because there are too many things that can go wrong with unpasteurized milk. People much wiser than I will tell you what those problems are and why it's important to prevent those problems. I know that you, because you're wise, educated, literate, understand that sort of thing. But we are also part of a global community right here in Salem, here in Oregon. There are many people who live here who are not educated, who are not particularly literate, who come from cultures where raw milk has been much more commonly used and easily accepted, and it is some of those people we need to protect other. This particular abuela, this grandmother, wants all grandchildren protected from the problems of raw milk, and I urge you to support this legislation to make sure that it happens.
I guess I have one question I just can't resist from asking. Don, do you buy your milk after it runs through the plant, or do you drink milk from your dairy straight from out of the cow?
Representative Wells, we do buy from the grocery store now. So.
Now that is unbelievable.
In the wintertime, the cow's butterfat goes up to nearly 4%, and that milk is so good. But my wife, she prefers the lower fat content, and so that's
another
what we drink.
Does milk, because it's pasteurized, necessarily have to be homogenized? And a lot
not
of
necessary.
Means that it's mixed, so you know milk, the cream does not rise to the top. So that's because of the homogenization process.
Can you ever buy any milk that's not homogenized? So you can get some cream to come to the top of it, even if it's been pasteurized?
Representative Wells and members of the committee, the pasteurized milk can be eliminated from the homogenizing process, and the cream would come up to the top, but I don't know whether it's available at the retail level.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, like all other farmers, dairy farmers want to concede to the wishes of the people who buy their product. You, sir, are the first person in an awfully long time who has asked for non-homogenized milk. It is for that same reason that 80% of it comes in jugs, that a huge percentage of it is low fat. We try to produce what you want, and we want it to be safe also.
Thank you very much. In the interest of time, it is a good testimony. Paul was handed out. Come on up, Paul. And
what do we have? Department of Ag. You might as well come on up too here, and everybody get everybody up here that's left on our list. Chuck and Ron.
Health Division visited with me last night about this and asked if they could come and testify. So I hope you don't read all of this here. This is quite a lot of reading material, but I think what's interesting, of course, is the list of diseases that evidently what we're interested in is the list of diseases that can come from bacteria, and I guess we're talking about bacteria that could be in raw milk, because I remember when we used to produce milk and put it in the cans and send it to the creamery at Mount Angel, we'd get back these tests showing, I guess, a bacteria level or something that was in our milk. That's the way it's tested.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dr. Paul Cieslak, and I work for the Communicable Disease Program at the State Health Division. Our job is to monitor the communicable diseases across the state, look into how they're spread, and come up with ways of stopping the spread. You have my testimony in front of you. I'll try to abbreviate it. Frankly, this was one of the easier assignments that I was given to prepare testimony for this bill, because there is such a wealth of medical literature out there about the pathogens, the bacteria associated with drinking raw milk. About 100 years ago in this country, because of these concerns, we decided that we were going to go with the pasteurization process, and now I'm sure that upwards of 99% of milk that people drink has been pasteurized. As a result, sometimes it's easy to forget about all the nasty diseases that you can get from drinking unpasteurized milk. You know, which after all does come from the underside of a cow. And because of that, it's easily contaminated with fecal organisms, and these are eliminated by pasteurization.
How do you pasteurize milk? You heat it?
Yes, exactly. You heat it up, not to boiling, not to a temperature to sterilize it, but just enough to kill the pathogens, which is generally about 140 degrees will do it. The higher you heat it, the less time you have to hold it there to kill the nasty bacteria. But I've included in the handout some of the medical literature that I looked at, detailing all the outbreaks that have occurred, you know, just in that small percentage of people who continue to drink unpasteurized milk. Most of the diseases are diarrheal diseases like salmonellosis, campylobacteriosis, E. coli 0157 infection, but there can be other diseases as well, and of course E. coli 0157 infection is complicated by kidney failure and necessity for dialysis in a small percentage of cases. This one paper in particular that shows campylobacter enteritis details over about 15 outbreaks over a 10-year period just in children who went to visit a dairy farm while on a school field trip, and you know, more than 15 outbreaks in the United States just over a 10-year period. We had one of those a couple of years ago in Oregon. I can respond to some of the questions that some of the other people have asked. I'll try my best to do so. I did call the feds about the current status of milk production in other states and pasteurization laws. There are 22 or 23 states that ban the sale of raw milk entirely. There are only 3 states, of which Oregon is one, that basically allow carte blanche sale of unpasteurized milk in any kind of setting. The other 2 are Idaho and New Mexico. So Idaho is one state that does allow sale of unpasteurized milk. And the rest of the states have basically banned the large-scale commercial production and either allow its sale on the farm or in some other circumstances. My wife is from Enterprise, Oregon. She grew up on a hay farm, and they have cows, and they produce and drink their own milk. My mother-in-law asked me about a year ago, because she was selling the raw milk to her neighbors, and she knew that I worked for the health department. She said, well, you know, should I be doing this? Maybe it's dangerous. I had to say, no, Mom, you probably should not be selling that unpasteurized milk to people. Most people who grow up on a farm and drink this stuff have actually gotten sick from it way back when, and over time develop a certain immunity to the bacteria that are in there. So we can tell by antibody testing, basically, who has grown up on a farm and who hasn't. But in fact, it's especially bad when you're selling this stuff to people who didn't grow up on a farm. And so I think they still drink their own raw milk out there, but they've stopped selling it to other people.
I think probably it's the difference between living in Mexico or visiting Mexico.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A little bit. We're used to certain bugs, but Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm still confused here in terms of we have these conflict amendments that if we pass Senate Bill 234 and becomes law, then we throw in sheep, but we're not going to worry about sheep unless Senate Bill 234 becomes law, because then we just only call it goats, not sheep. And then we're taking the way that these amendments are drafted, there is no requirement or prohibition on selling cow's milk if the herd is tested positive with brucellosis. I appreciate the fact that we're brucellosis free, so therefore it shouldn't matter about goats then either. But the way I'm just curious why this was crafted this way, that in Section 3 it only calls out goats, and then if Senate Bill 234, then we add sheep into the mix, and we take away the prohibition of selling cow's milk if brucellosis is found in the herd. Because that prohibition would only exist for goats in Section 3 or in Section 4 for sheep and goats, cows.
Mr. Chairman.
Harrison, just a minute. Let's get Harrison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, I wanted to say with respect to the I didn't look at the conflict amendments closely, but sheep, I believe, were included in Senate Bill 234, so this is corrected to conform with what we've already done in that bill. But that's for that part of your question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, I think the distinction between cows and goats is because all the cow's milk will be required to be pasteurized, you're less concerned about whether it might have brucellosis in it. If it does, the brucella bacteria are going to die during the pasteurization process, whereas if you're going to sell the goat's milk unpasteurized, then it had better come from a disease-free herd. I cannot speak to the sheep issue.
I think with that, we're moving right along here. Chuck and Ron, what do you have? You've heard all the good questions. You ought to have all the better answers now.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Chuck Craig with Department of Ag. With me is Ron McKay from our department. We will not repeat what's already been said by our able colleagues from the health department. But what I do want to say is that this is a very real problem. In the last few years, there literally have been hundreds of cases of foodborne illness caused by people consuming raw milk or raw milk products in the Pacific Northwest. We have had to respond to numerous of those cases ourselves, and as we sit here and speak today, we are responding to one. So we support the efforts to further restrict the sale of raw milk. I can't really speak to the idiosyncrasies of the goat's milk issue in the bill since we didn't draft it. We're happy that somebody is dealing with the product that probably 99% of Oregonians consume as their source of milk, since it will make a significant difference in protecting public health, in our opinion.
Ron, what do you have to say?
Mr. Chairman, Ron McKay. I'm the administrator of the Food Safety Division at the Department of Agriculture, and the testimony is written and before you, and maybe what I can do is assist with answering any questions that there are at this time.
As I remember the issue, of course, we had it around 95 or 97 session, and this was an issue of I guess, taking away people's rights to produce a product and people want to take the risk of buying it. And it's taken a little time to evolve to get this far. This has been controversial. I also know dairy herds who have sold raw milk and have taken quite a risk when some diseases came in. And they couldn't maybe ever specifically trace it to that herd, but there was enough perception out there that put them out of business. And some people really got hurt pretty badly. If you want to go into a risky business, develop a dairy herd selling raw milk, and then have this one or two people get sick and start making accusations, and pretty soon you can't sell your milk at all. And so it is a very risky business. And you know, and that's probably the reason why we don't have any commercial dairy herds anymore left. People just, I don't think it would be a banker in the country and loan a dairyman money to produce raw milk. It's too risky, Representative Hill.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I guess just my own idiosyncrasy, can I ask that we have committee staff request amendments redrafted that we just get rid of it and we just go to the Senate Bill 234, since we've already discussed it out of this committee, and just adopt the Section 4 and Section 5 language? I mean, it just seems silly to me that we have the two different things, and then maybe get with Dave and make sure that we're Dave, it just seems to me that why are we doing it this way? If we have, as a committee, have already passed out Senate Bill 234, we might as well just change the bill to conform with how we've already done it, be consistent coming out of here, because I don't think it would be inconsistent anywhere else if we did that, because it would still have a prohibition on unpasteurized milk if we just adopted Section 4 and Section 6 of the bill, and then also fix it so that we still have the prohibition of selling milk from herds that have brucellosis, just cows as well.
I think I would defer to Dave Nelson to work with Harrison on this issue that you brought up, and we'll see where we are. I don't have a good answer for sure, not having, I guess, taken enough time to really look at what you're really talking about here and what 234 does say to make a decision. So that's something that, this is the dairy farmer's bill, so I'll defer to Dave to work on this issue. Anything else we need to be moving here? I think we have any other questions from the committee?
Since we didn't talk about what the real controversial issues which are going to be showing up here in terms about the milk compact, that's going to, when do you plan on having this go back? So
when we get the amendments.
Okay.
I haven't seen any amendments yet.
Okay.
So when we get the amendments, yes.
Mr. Chair, I just have one question for Dr. Cieslak, if I may. All of the and some of the new types of bacteria that we see showing up and that sort of thing. How much of our reduced immunity is because of all of the processes that we have over time, particularly in this century, invented, such as pasteurization and homogenization, and you know all of these things sort of led to us as humans actually having a reduced immunity as opposed to an increased immunity. And what made me think of that was, you know, somebody mentioned, you know, well, if you living in Mexico is a lot different than visiting Mexico. If you grew up on a farm and you drank the raw milk, you know, you don't get sick. But if you grew up in a city and you did drink the pasteurized milk, how much of that do you think, and how much of the new stuff that we're seeing coming out as a result of that? And maybe you don't know.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kremel, thanks for the question. A little bit difficult to answer. I don't think that any of the new diseases that we see have anything to do with any reduced immunity in the human population. As far as, you know, the comparison with growing up in Mexico or growing up on a farm, you know, it is true that we will have less immunity to some of those diseases than someone in Mexico who has grown up with them and lived with them. However, the toll that they exact while you're growing up is something that we would consider intolerable. Diarrheal diseases, excuse me, are one of the main causes of death in developing countries because these little kids get dehydrated, they don't have intravenous equipment to rehydrate them, and often diarrhea, especially from parasites, can persist for months and months, and meanwhile, kids are needing to develop, their brains are suffering from lack of nutrition. The toll is really phenomenal. And I think we would be unwilling to put up with that palpable, visible toll on children in order to gain, you know, immunity that is theoretically going to benefit us as adults.
Thank you. I appreciate what you're saying. And the question then isn't when you grow up, it's if you grow up. I would point out for the committee's benefit, in the handout from Dr. Cieslak, so at the top of the page it says state of the art. It's the article about unpasteurized milk. I think it's the second one back. And one of the comments in here, Dr. Cieslak just alluded to, is the number of infant deaths due to diarrhea in Washington, D.C. dropped from 477 in 1894, the year before sanitary requirements for milk were strengthened, to 72 in 1909. So just in a very short 35-year period, you saw a dramatic drop in infant deaths.
So with that, close the hearing on Bill 1212, and see you on Thursday. We're adjourned. Thank you very much.